Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I am absolutely thrilled to introduce my guest today. We're joined by Gail Collins, and she has written a new biography of William Henry Harrison. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Gail, this is like old home week here. We've got William Henry Harrison, who lived near Cincinnati. We've got Gail Collins, who grew up in Cincinnati. This is going to be airing in Southwest Ohio. This is fun.
This is hometown day.
So how did you get hooked into doing a project about a president that was president for a month?
Well, the Times, you know, has the New York Times and has a book series on all the presidents that is very cool. They're short biographies of about 150 to 200 pages, and different person does each one of them. And at one point along the way, they asked me if I'd like to do one, and I picked William Henry, partly because he was from Ohio, from Cincinnati, partly because I thought, well, with 1 month, I'm probably not going to have to say much about monetary policy, so that would be good. And partly because I had this connection, strange connection to him. When I was in Cincinnati doing publicity for a book I wrote some time ago about gossip and politics, I was at home and I was telling my family that William Henry had been sold as a presidential candidate as this old soldier sitting in a log cabin drinking hard cider, a man of the people, where in fact he was the son of a signer of the Declaration of Independence. And I said, and he lived in a really big, nice house. And my father was sitting there, and he said, yes, that was a big house. And I said, how did you know? And he said, I tore it down. So it turned out that the house, it actually had been one of the houses in the family compound there. It was the final house, the house that Harrison's widow and his son, and where Benjamin Harrison, the next Harrison president, was born. It had been on the power plant site, and my father worked for the gas and electric company, and the gas and electric company was worried that it was going to be landmarked, and they'd be stuck with this thing there forever. So they sent a team of men out one night to tear it down, and my father led the team. So I thought I kind of owed him some little thing there, you know.
And William Henry, he was a guy who said a lot of firsts. He was the oldest president up to that point. He was the first president to die in office. He's the only president who's ever been grandfather of a president. His grandson became president. But William Henry, this is all rather amazing because he was the youngest, and it's just bizarre. His whole story is strange.
It's a very interesting story. I think it's a story you would never find in another period in American history because it was such a weird time. It's really my favorite period, that sort of middle of the 19th century before the Civil War, when things were just being settled and there were so many great moral issues being debated and the economy was such a mess. It was growing, but it was totally chaotic. So you could make a whole bunch of money and then lose a whole bunch of money almost instantaneously. Things were always going bankrupt and bust, and it was an uncomfortable period. A sort of, you're sitting around in dark houses all the time trying to just get through the day. It's much different from now, and it created a presidential campaign that was very like many of ours today. It was the craziest campaign in American history when they ran William Henry Harrison.
And he consistently had financial problems. He had a lot of dependents, a lot of people living with him, and he was always looking for that new job, wasn't he?
It's true. That was really the story of his life. I mean, he was not a major political figure in the country by any means. When the Whigs first nominated him for president in 1836, he was the Cincinnati clerk of courts. This was not a guy who was, you know, out there leading the major debates of the day. But all of his life, he had 10 children, and most of them lived to adulthood, which was very unusual at that point in time. They all married and had children. Then they started dying off. So he had tons of orphans and widows and dependents and old soldiers who remembered him and old war hero friends that were all coming around, and he prided himself on being a good host. So he just had enormous expenses keeping all these people going. And he really spent most of his life just trying to get another job, writing letters saying, you know, do you think I should go and invade Mexico for you? You know, what can I do? You know, could I be ambassador to some place? Could I be vice president? It doesn't take much effort. And on and on and on. And he was actually very happy being clerk of courts because he made quite a good living doing that. But then destiny called.
And didn't he go from being clerk of courts to being president?
Yep, that was the amazing trajectory. Yeah, and the other thing that they liked about him was that the Whigs as a party were, and this is kind of familiar to people today too, were totally identified with hating Andrew Jackson. Uh-huh. They hated Andrew Jackson, and that was the thing that brought them together. But beyond that, they had nothing in common. They had a very strong abolitionist piece, and they had a very strong slave-owning piece. They had a very strong pro-bank piece and a very strong anti-bank piece, which was a big deal back then. So there was really nothing holding them together, and all of the major politicians and thinkers in the party, like Henry Clay and Daniel Webster, were not acceptable to one chunk or another because everybody knew how they stood on the big issues. William Henry had been sitting around in Cincinnati being clerk of courts. He wasn't identified with any big issues, and he sort of jumped around on the big issues in a very tidy way so that no one really did know what he thought, and he was a war hero. So what could be better, a war hero with no positions on anything?
And when Andrew Jackson faded into the twilight, the Whigs faded out as well. Didn't they pretty much turn into the Republicans in a way?
Later on, they lived as long as Henry Clay, who was really their great man, lived. And they finally did get one other president, Zachary Taylor, who also died very soon after he got into office. So the Whigs certainly had bad luck with their presidents, if nothing else. And then they did really start morphing into the Republican Party.
Gail Collins joins us. She's written a new biography of William Henry Harrison. It's part of this lovely series, The American Presidents, that the late Arthur Schlesinger was very, very much influential in creating. And I think the last guest that we had on this program from this series wrote a biography of Abe Lincoln, and he knew a little bit about something, a little something about running for president. That was George McGovern. We had him. And that was wonderful to talk to him about politics. And you have such a great style of writing. I knew when I opened this book that you were going to throw some humor in here because that's just what you do so well. You always find mirth in stuff that is sometimes kind of serious. And at one point, I just had to laugh because you're talking about William Henry's dad, who was one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, and he sounds like a larger-than-life character, and they were just signing it, and he turned to this little guy, and you threw in this statement that he made.
Yes, he said, I think it was Elbridge Gerry, who was a very tiny guy from Massachusetts, and he said, well, if the British come to kill us all, I'll do very well because I'll hang very fast, given my bulk. But you, Mr. Gerry, are going to jump around for many hours on the rope before you're finally done in. He was quite a guy. Within the family, you know, he was called the signer, of course, because he signed the Declaration of Independence, and he was sort of the great Benjamin, the great Harrison. And then William Henry was the youngest son of a very large family, so he kind of came at the tail end and wasn't really given any of the preparation for a great career that his older brothers got. He was sent off to become a doctor because I think that was a cheap way to kind of educate him. But as soon as his father died, he instantly dropped that and joined the army, went off to Cincinnati to fight the Indians.
I think if you're ever looking for the definition of gallows humor, that is it. Gail Collins joins us. He went into the military, and he ended up at what became Cincinnati. And he was in the military till he was, what, 41 years old? And he's very much associated with the Battle of Tippecanoe, but he really had very little to do with it, didn't he?
Well, he it was his battle, but it wasn't much of a battle, actually. He was the country, the Western country, was absolutely obsessed with Tecumseh, the great Indian chief, the great Shawnee chief, who was trying to unite all the different tribes together. And his argument, his plea to the tribes, was that they stop signing over their land to the white Americans, because what the white Americans tended to do was to find a smaller, weaker tribe in an area, get them to sign over all the land, but the land was actually owned in common by all the different tribes. So the tribes were losing out. They were getting pushed further and further out. William Henry was really the genius of signing these treaties. He collected millions of acres. Most of the state of Illinois was bought from the Indians by William Henry. But Tecumseh established a place called Tippecanoe, at Tippecanoe. It was called Prophet's Town. It was sort of the utopian village of his campaign. A lot of women and children and some young braves, and people were getting nervous about it. And finally, William Henry led an army to confront Tecumseh there. Tecumseh was nowhere around. He had gone far away. I think he was in South Carolina at that point, so he had nothing to do with it. William Henry did burn down the village, but in the process, he lost a ton of men, which didn't seem to be necessary. It was sort of a very badly handled attack at the time, it seemed like it, but everybody was so desirous to think that this problem was over, that it was okay and that they were safe and things could go on as they wanted them to, that it was sort of decided by general acclamation that this was a great victory. And it also sounded good. Tippecanoe is a very neat word. So he was old Tippecanoe for the rest of his life, even though it was not, I mean, it was sort of a dumb at best victory. He had a much bigger victory during the War of 1812 at the Battle of the Thames in Canada, which was a very decisive victory, although once again he outnumbered his opponents, you know, hugely. But Tecumseh was in that battle too, and the British ran away seeing the size of Harrison's army. Tecumseh and his men stayed to fight because they wanted to protect their women and children who were trying to escape. And Tecumseh was killed in that battle, but not by William Henry.
And
he was killed by a guy actually from Kentucky named Richard Johnson, or maybe was killed. The best anybody could guess, it might have been Richard Johnson, who went on then to a political career. And Martin Van Buren, fearing the greatness of the William Henry Harrison battle name, picked Johnson to be his vice president. And theoretically, when people came up to you and said Tippecanoe and Tyler too, which was the great campaign theme for William Henry, you were supposed to go back and say, "Rumpty, umpty, umpty, tumpty, Colonel Johnson killed Tecumseh." It never really worked. That shows you why Martin Van Buren lost the election.
Well,
didn't quite make it.
They also portrayed Martin Van Buren as this guy who loved French wine and,
big spender.
Big spender. Whereas...
This is very familiar, I think, to people today, too, that the Van Buren people decided early on that they were not going to win this campaign against Harrison by talking about the great achievements of Martin Van Buren, who had a terrible economic collapse during his presidency. So they decided they would just be negative, and then the Harrison people decided they would just be negative, and it was this terrible screaming back-and-forth campaign. And Van Buren, who was born in very humble circumstances, unlike William Henry, who was born on a plantation with, large plantation with slaves and all the trappings. Poor Van Buren was born in a tavern. He had to really claw his way up. But he was portrayed as this wealthy guy with dining off gold plates in the White House, while William Henry was sitting in his log cabin. The whole thing was a total fiction from beginning to end. It was really amazing.
170 years ago, and it all sounds very familiar.
Isn't it funny?
We're standing right now here in the studio. We're 8 miles from where Tecumseh was born. And when I read in your book about what they did to Tecumseh, which I'm not going to say anything about here, I was just appalled. And I had never known that before. We're joined by Gail Collins. The book is her biography of William Henry Harrison. It's part of this wonderful American Presidents series. It was just published by Times Books. And I must say that Harrison reminds me a little bit of one of our current candidates in his way of being on different sides of the issues, just depending upon who he was speaking to. It's like if this group was for slavery, he was for slavery. If this group was against slavery, he was against slavery, et cetera. He was really good at dancing around the issues, wasn't he?
Yeah, and it was so much easier back then when you didn't have YouTube to follow you around to just say whatever you were going to say. But I think if you look at his actual, it's sort of like many of the candidates today, if you look at them, you can kind of figure out what their actual thing is. And I think, you know, Harrison was one of those Southern moderates who thought that people who own slaves should be allowed to keep them, but that there shouldn't be any, you know, further expansion of slavery or selling of people back and forth anymore. And he followed that through pretty well during his own career, and for what it was worth. But he also did that on banks. In theory, he was against congressional power. He was for congressional power against presidential vetoes, which was a big Andrew Jackson thing. So the Whigs all hated presidential vetoes. But then when he finally did give his inaugural speech, he said he would never, ever veto any legislation unless it was clearly against the best interest of the American people, which covers a lot of territory when you get right down to it.
Gail Collins joins us. And Gail, I must confess, one of the highlights of my day is when I see you have a column in the New York Times, and you've been. I love reading your stuff, and you've been covering these primaries, these GOP candidates, and I was brokenhearted when Herman Cain dropped out, and then it hurt me even more when Michelle Bachmann dropped out, because it seemed like we lost some of the humor. But when I read your columns, there's always something funny in there, and I've got to admit, the first thing I look at is I want to see what Seamus is up to this week.
Seamus would be Mitt Romney's former dog, yes.
Yes. I'm so proud of you.
Thank you. Always happy to point out that Mitt Romney once drove to Canada with his dog in a crate on the roof of the car.
And I think that says it all.
It works for me.
Yeah. And I'm a person who loves dogs who doesn't understand how anyone could do that. And I'm guessing maybe you feel that way too.
Well, yeah, and you know, as the story goes on, Seamus soils himself in the car, and then Romney hoses them down, and then gets back in the car and drives on further up. So the dog is now wet on top of the car. He cannot have been happy, but Seamus is not with us anymore, so he has no way of testifying himself as to how he felt.
Poor Seamus, but fortunately, Gail Collins is here to speak out for Seamus on a regular basis, and I don't think you've missed a column where you've mentioned Mitt and Seamus hasn't been in there. How many columns now?
That's quite a while. I'm not actually keeping count, but I'm at least going to carry it on through the primaries. I don't know if I can manage to hold this up during the entire election campaign.
Well, it certainly has been an amusing process. And to watch them scrambling around and to watch these debates, I get a lot of humor out of it.
Well, you know, one of my goals in life is to make people be interested in politics without making them feel they need to bang their heads against the wall or slit their wrists. So if that makes you feel that way, it makes me happy.
I remember when you got the position running the editorial pages at the New York Times, and wow, that was fabulous. And now you've got this nice gig writing columns, and I'm wondering what that's like for you. What's the process
of writing the column?
Yeah.
I really enjoy it so much, and you know, I just wait and see what's happening, and I try to get as close to the news as I can. And I have a wonderful assistant who helps with the research, and the Times is just a great place to work for. They're totally supportive. They will send us anywhere we want to go. So I get to travel a lot. It all works out great.
Are you in Florida right now, or are you in New York?
No, I'm going to skip Florida. I have commitments here that I have to keep up, but if it goes past Florida, I'll be off to Nevada, I think.
Well, lucky you. So how long were you out in Iowa following that?
I didn't do Iowa. That was so close to my family's various holiday celebrations that I skipped it and went right to New Hampshire. I sort of greeted everybody else at the airport when they got to New Hampshire. I'm really an opponent of the Iowa caucuses. I think it's the dumbest thing in the history of the world, and I sort of wish we would stop encouraging them so much.
Well, I think the miscount might have hurt the Iowa caucuses.
Well, you know, the whole thing is crazy. It's very, it's a very selective group that you get who are able and willing to come out at exactly 7 o'clock at night and do, you know, sit with their neighbors. It's sort of sweet and cute when it happens, but it's not a primary election. It's just sort of a consultation with the people who are most intense. And in a state that's not very representative, I would be happy to see Ohio get in there earlier.
Well, it's
a much more representative state.
It's not too far away from Ohio.
I know. I'll be there, too, if it keeps going on.
So you grew up in Cincinnati. Where'd you go to high school?
I went to Seton High School on the Western Hills side of Cincinnati.
That sounds Catholic.
It was very Catholic.
Okay.
Yes.
There was
the Western Hills, my area that I come from, is really very largely Catholic.
Did you ever come out to Yellow Springs?
No, I never have, and I've heard so many wonderful things about it, so you have to invite me.
Well, that's where we are. When you come out for the Ohio primary, you'll have to come through town.
I will.
This William Henry Harrison biography, as we get to the point where he's elected president, and we see all these bizarre things going on where they're all drinking heavily, and he's pretty much a teetotaler. And they're saying he lives in a log cabin when he really just lives in this house where they have one exposed log that they haven't covered up.
Yeah, you could go and look in this one bedroom, and in the closet there was an exposed log so that you could see that at one point in history there was somewhere in the property a log cabin, but that was about it.
And the poor guy, we know he's doomed. And you show us how that transpired. You show us how they wouldn't let him sleep, and they were besieging him for jobs, and the poor guy, he was almost a martyr.
So a good way of thinking, although I have to say he was also really happy. I mean, this is a man who never in a billion years imagined becoming president, and there he was, and he was just, I think it was Martin Van Buren who said he was like a girl with a new frock. He was just so happy and dancing around, and he went off by himself. He would go walking through town in Washington, shaking everybody's hand and saying hello, and was, of course, besieged by people who wanted jobs everywhere he went. And you think just shaking hands day and night for a long period of time, you would come up with a lot of germs. And he was frazzled and tired, and he was, by the standards of the day, really an old guy. He was 68. And then he gives his inaugural speech, the longest inaugural speech in the history of the American presidency, 2 hours, in the cold and rain, and without a hat or an umbrella, and he catches pneumonia or a cold, and then the doctors come in. Of course, the doctors killed him, if nothing else did. Mm-hmm. They bled him and blistered him and did all the horrible things they did back then, and that was the end of the Harrison presidency.
So he suffered at the hands of the same kind of physicians that treated another Ohio president, James Garfield.
Yes, although clearly, Garfield would have lived if doctors had let him alone. He was a much younger and stronger man.
And the speech, this sounds like the most horrible, boring speech.
Oh, it was awful. Daniel Webster told people that he had been asked to read it ahead of time, and he said, "I killed off a number of Roman generals dead as smelts, but there are still quite a few left," because Harrison was just taken by his classical education and was constantly saying, "Even as the Roman general yada yada did or said," and with these long, florid references to, you know, things nobody else understood, classical allusions, and it's just all very vague and pompous. The first sentence was 100 words long, which gives you an idea of what was to come. But I do think that partly he liked to give long speeches to show people he was vigorous, because, of course, people talked about the fact that he was so old by their standards to be running for president. So he was the first president to campaign personally. Nobody had ever done that before, and he really enjoyed it. He loved going out and shaking hands with all the old soldiers, and giving long, 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 boring speeches.
He did speak up for veterans. You've got to give him credit
for that. He did, always did. I mean, he was a very, his men always loved him. He was very humble. He didn't make a fuss about himself. He always ate the same things his men did, and he lived in the same conditions they did. And he was very friendly with them. He was never stuck up. And then when they had needs, he was always there for them.
And when he died a month after being elected, this was a big shock because no one had ever known a president to die before, and a vice president had never been in a position to take over. And suddenly, everything was a jumble because they didn't really know anything about Vice President Tyler, did they?
No, they didn't know, for instance, that he agreed with the Whigs about nothing whatsoever. That would have been, it was a big surprise when they discovered that one. They picked him for really silly reasons, and it was all a sort of a random process of looking for somebody from the South who looked like he might appear to be a Clay supporter, because the Clay supporters were very unhappy at the loss of the presidency for their guy. And there was a rumor that he had been seen weeping after Clay lost, which turned out to be totally untrue. But he didn't agree with them. He was a very conservative Southern plantation owner, and once he got into office, that's the way he governed.
The books in this series are what I would call pocket-sized books. They're hardcovers, but they're very quick reads. They're only 100, 150 pages long. And I'm thinking it must have been a tough process for you to decide what to leave out, because there must have been so much that you couldn't put in.
Well, no, not for me. I think for the guy who did Lincoln, it was a problem. But, he was only in office for 1 month, and he didn't actually do anything during that month. So I had plenty of space, actually.
Okay. Well, you did include the first 100 words of that speech, which did make me slightly suspicious.
Yes, yes. You, if it had been any longer, you would have gotten large context of the speech.
Are there any books in this series that haven't come out yet?
There's three or four more to go. I'm sorry that I don't know exactly which ones they are, but they should be finished very soon. We're really coming to the end of the series. Then they haven't come out in any particular order. It's not, obviously, since William Henry is sort of in the middle there.
Right. I think the Andrew Johnson was the last one I remember.
Well, they're all coming out very soon. You'll have the entire set.
The George W. Bush is the one I'm waiting for.
Yeah, he should be out soon. I think they won't do Obama until after he leaves office,
right. Obviously. Well,
Gail,
it's really been a pleasure having you on the program.
It's a pleasure to be here. Say hi to everybody in Ohio for me.
We will, and we'll be looking for you for the Ohio primary.
Oh, yes, I can't wait.
The book is William Henry Harrison. Gail Collins wrote it, published by Times Books. The shortest presidency in history, but well worth reading about. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks for listening. The Leuven brothers, Ira and Charlie Leuven, are considered to be the greatest country duo in music history. Ira Leuven left us many years ago. Charlie died a year ago. Before he passed, he told his story to Ben Whitmer. Next week, we'll be hearing about it. It's called Satan is Real. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.